Well, let's start. Can you tell me a little bit, Gabriella, about your journey, even going back so far as to your childhood?
Yes, that's when it started for me. I was 5 when I told my sister that I was going to be a priest when I grew up.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just a matter of playing Mass. I fell in love with God very early. And,
It wasn't just about Necco wafers.
No, it wasn't. I'm Italian, so for me...
So am I.
Another thing in common.
Right.
So for me, it was Tironi Ferrara. You know, the wafer on the top and the bottom? We
yes.
use that as the communion.
But you say it really was deeper than that, even
Absolutely.
At that...
Absolutely.
So talk about that. What did you mean?
Yeah.
First of all, were you going to a Catholic nursery school?
I started the first grade. I didn't go to a kindergarten or a nursery school, so it was the first grade, and I was 5
mm-hmm.
in the first grade. And, I just felt really close to God and the saints and loved Mass and loved benediction.
Benediction.
Yeah, remember that?
Yeah, you mean the very ceremonial processing with the host in a monstrance?
Yes.
Yes.
I still love it.
Yeah.
And actually, at some point, I'd love to preside at a benediction service, but as meditation.
Oh.
I taught meditation for about 10 years. So it's a very meditative kind of liturgy. And it reaches all of your senses.
Oh, make sure that when we're done with your chronology that we touch on that. I'm interested in it.
Okay.
So you're a 5-year-old. You're loving God.
Yes.
You tell your sister, I'm going to be a priest.
Yeah. I'm an artist also, and I started drawing, even at that age, chalices and monstrances and tabernacles.
On them or drawing pictures of them?
Drawing pictures of them.
Oh.
Yeah. And vestments. And I knew all of the colors of the vestments and what time of year they were worn.
Goodness.
So having
And that red was for martyrs and green was for ordinary time. And you knew all that?
Yes, I knew all of that. Yeah. And if I were a boy, my teachers would have said, a vocation.
Mm.
But I was not. I'm a girl. So
right. And what did your sister say when you
My sister
her?
Said, ha, you can't. You're a girl.
Ah.
Yeah.
And was that news to you?
Yes, it was. I didn't realize that at that point, that being a girl would prevent me from being a priest.
Do you remember how you felt to hear that?
Oh, yeah. Disappointed, betrayed, all kinds of things. I don't know if I could have said it in those words at that point, but that's what the feelings were. The call was so strong for me, though, that by the third grade, I was in a vocation club.
A vocation club?
Yeah.
Was it with boys?
No. My Catholic school had girls on one side and boys on the other side of the school, and you were in trouble if you crossed the boundary.
So you were, in effect, pretending you were interested in becoming a nun.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know what to do with it at that point. I mean, even as a 6, 7, 8-year-old. I didn't know what to do with it. I knew that I was wanting to dedicate my life to God, and I didn't know how.
Wow.
So that was one part of it.
What's wrong with, why didn't you want to be a nun? Why didn't you say, well, you know, I could always be a nun?
That wasn't it.
Yeah.
That wasn't what the thing was about. I knew that when I drew those symbols, those objects, the chalice, the monstrance, I knew that they pointed to something larger than the object themselves. I knew at that young age the depth and mystery of God.
And it was very much about the Eucharist, it sounds like.
Yeah, sacraments, yes.
Yeah.
Especially the Eucharist, yeah.
So then what happened?
Well, it sent me in two directions. I started saying girls are just as good as boys, and they can do anything that boys can do. And
what decade are we in, if I may be so?
1950s.
Okay, so this was maybe not something people readily accepted.
No, and when I started putting she before he grammatically, I got into trouble.
Wow.
And I refused to read any books about boys. So that was one thing, and that kind of led me in a lifelong search for justice for people who are oppressed and victimized and things like that, because because I experienced that so young. So that's another part of it.
Yeah.
The other part is, how do I fit into this church that doesn't accept the vocation of girls?
Some people might have said, well, I'm done.
Well, I went to 12 years of Catholic school. I started reading religious philosophers at the age of 10. And, yeah, I read the Bhagavad Gita at the age of 16, got into Buddhism, and by the time I graduated high school, I was no longer finding God in the Roman Catholic Church. So I started looking all over. In my 20s, I started going. I didn't go very often, but I did go to Baha'i services. Later in life, I...
Tell me, just quickly, what was it about the Baha'i faith that attracted you?
I was just searching. Yeah. I just was trying to find that mystery that I found and the depth that I knew as a child, and I was trying to find it somewhere.
Right.
And as I said, I spent 6 years in a Native American prayer group.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was looking in many different traditions.
Yeah.
And now I can say, too, that... I was looking at all of these traditions because I knew that all the answers were not found in the one church, and that finding the way other people see God and experience God was, for me, a way of knowing more about God.
Okay. So nothing's wasted, in effect.
Yeah.
All those years applying other faiths.
Yes. Nothing's wasted. That's right.
Well, then what happened?
I stopped going to church.
Okay.
And
at what point in your life were you here?
Probably about 20 by that point.
Okay. Were you too angry too?
Yeah. And I just didn't. And I felt and I sensed the hypocrisy. I was 20 in 1967. So by that time, a lot of things have happened in the church. I was probably on and off from 63, 64 to 67 about going to church. And those were the years that Vatican II happened, too.
Right.
And a lot of things were changing. I really wasn't aware of it because I was distancing myself from the church.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So then?
So I was married at 20.
Okay.
And had my son at 20.
Mm-hmm.
And got into some political things, too, and demonstrations. It was the Vietnam War period.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, always taking the side of the person who, or the people who are being oppressed.
Yeah.
You know? And that continued for quite a long time and still is part of my life.
I can imagine.
Yeah. So I was married for about 10 years.
Okay.
And... had two children.
Yeah.
We separated when I was 30.
Okay.
And I raised my two children alone as a single parent.
All right.
And it was at that point a matter of surviving. So any thoughts or desires about church or vocation or any of that did not make themselves known at
right.
that point.
You were too busy putting food on the table.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what did you do for a living?
I was studying art, but that didn't help very much, making money. I had a lot of odd jobs. I worked in a gourmet shop. I made miniatures for dollhouses. I was a photographer for 4 years. But that really didn't pay much either.
So you were patching together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I left the marriage, actually, when my daughter was 2 months old. So it was a period which I did not work.
Wow.
Outside the home for a salary. I certainly did work inside the home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So through all of this, was your faith very... was it an issue? Was it in the forefront of your consciousness, or were you just...
No, it wasn't, really. There were periods of time. See, I was a cultural Catholic when I was a kid, as far as my family was concerned, being Italian. It was very important as far as holidays go and family gatherings, and it really wasn't the connection with God. And
so it started when you were five, but then it kind of waned?
I wouldn't say waned. It was there all along, because sometimes I would pray to Jesus or say the rosary or that kind of thing. And when my daughter was three, I started going back to church, but the emphasis was on giving money, and I was living in poverty.
Right.
It was just difficult having a three-year-old there and not being able to give.
Right.
So I stopped going.
Okay.
But when she was 10, a friend and I decided that we would shop around for a church that we could feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
And a place that we could feel safe in also, especially since I now have a daughter as well as a son. And we did find a church that I could feel safe in.
Was it a Catholic church?
It was a Catholic church.
With an enlightened pastor?
Yes, he was a feminist.
Okay.
The first time I went to that church, I remember his homily was about his walk person. Not about his walk man, but about his walk person. I said, what's this? So I came back, and I remember another homily soon after that, in which this was a period when the bishops were saying that they were going to excommunicate politicians who were pro-choice.
Yes.
And so this priest gave a homily on the history of excommunication, and he said that the bishops should, instead of pointing at these other folks, should look at their own houses and clean their own houses before condemning women who are put in a position of needing to have an abortion.
Wow.
He also, at another time, he got up and he said he apologized to the women in the church for the way the church has treated them in the last 2,000 years.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Is this priest still among us?
No, he's not. He's an ancestor now.
He
died in 92.
I love that. He's an ancestor now.
Yeah.
That's nice. Is that from your Native American experience?
That and my connections with the African American community.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, so you're not going to church, and then what happens?
Well, then we found this parish.
Right,
and
right.
I became, well, the reason we were looking was to teach the children about the tradition. And I had previously been teaching them about religion as history.
Mm-hmm.
I taught them about the Norse gods and the Greek gods and the Indian gods and... I wasn't teaching them about Christianity, so I figured if they were going to reject it, they had to know what it was they were rejecting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's where we started the search. But when I found this church, I got so involved in it because it was something that called me and drew me so into it that I got very, very involved in it. And
okay.
Before long, I was spending every night during the week there in ministry.
Wow.
Volunteering. Volunteering, yes. I was so active that people thought I was on staff.
Wow.
I was teaching adult religious education and baptism classes. I took over for the pastor when he couldn't be at these classes. Adult religious education, spirituality, scripture study, feminist theology.
I get the feeling you're one of those people who jumps in with both feet.
I guess so. Yeah, so on and on. I mean, I was also called the director for the environment for liturgies.
Oh.
I was the Eucharistic minister. I was a lector. At times I was preaching. Not
My
in the church.
My goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. And as the director for the environment for major liturgies, I was given the keys to the church.
Oh.
And so I did paintings there, and I did a creation of wreaths for Christmas and things like that. So,
were you happy?
Oh, it was a wonderful time. It was a difficult time because during this period I was raising two kids in poverty.
Yeah.
But it was a very wonderful period also at the same time. Yeah.
Okay.
So I spent many, many nights in the church alone, and before long I was spending time in the church without needing to do the work necessary for the environment. So I was spending much time in the... Oh, I taught meditation there, too, in the sanctuary.
Was it a Buddhist style or Christian style?
Well, it was a combination. It was based on the work of Anthony DeMello, who was a Jesuit from Goa, India.
Okay.
So he connected the Eastern techniques with Christian mysticism. And so that's the method that I taught for 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So since I had the keys to the church, I began spending many nights, many, many hours in the dark in prayer.
Yeah.
And while I was doing that, eventually the call came back.
Uh-huh.
Very strongly.
Yeah.
And
I'm sorry, I just want to ask, because mm-hmm. listeners may be wondering, you're in the church in the middle of the night, who's watching the kids?
By that time they were older, but my mother had them most of the time.
Okay.
I wasn't there. Yes.
And you're in New York, it's like,
Yeah, no, they're not running around the street.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, my son is 10 years older than my daughter, so he was old enough to be on his own, but she was a teenager.
Okay.
Yeah, so my mother kept an eye on them, yeah.
So back to the call, you felt, I mean, it's not surprising to me somehow, the person who's spending so much time in a dark church in the quiet would feel some kind of result, you know?
Well, the call was very, very strong.
And the call was, be a priest.
Yes, yeah.
And this was what year? Mm-hmm.
This was by now 94.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're up against the same obstacles that you were when you were five. So
yes.
What did you do?
In fact, by 94, the Pope had come out with the Sacerdotalis, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. Which is the document that says that priesthood is reserved for men alone.
And that we can't even really talk about it.
That's right.
If I recall.
That's right. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm always tempted to reply, you know what? This is America.
Well, you know, I remember it hit the papers, and you can't talk about it. And the whole controversy made everybody talk about it even more than before.
Of course.
So it was.
And this
it
is
was
John
really
Paul II.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So many smiles, and yet, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, don't get me started. So, yes, here you are feeling the call, instructed not even to talk about it, and, you know, then what?
I talked a lot about it with my spiritual director, who was the then pastor of that church.
Okay.
I spent a lot of nights in prayer.
Yes.
Asking God why.
Right.
Why am I being called so hard, so forcefully, so strongly, and not able to fulfill it? Why? And I spent time at the altar saying the words that women are forbidden to say, and at the pulpit preaching to the pews.
Wow.
And,
oh,
yeah,
that's just beautiful.
It was difficult. It was a very difficult time. I decided that what it meant was that I should be the priesthood of the baptized, you know. And so I was already ministering to people in many different ways. We had three language communities. One of them was a Haitian-speaking or a Haitian culture, and another was Spanish-speaking and the English-speaking. And I ministered to all of them, and not being on staff.
Yeah.
So,
wow. So what did you do?
Well, I did feel that it was the priesthood of the baptized, but it wasn't enough. There was still an emptiness inside of me.
So when you say that, just explain, what do you mean, the priesthood to the baptized? What do you mean?
Yeah, we by right of baptism, we are called to priesthood without being ordained. So there are two types, really, of priesthood.
So you basically told yourself, well, I'm doing priestly things in my daily life. I don't need to be ordained.
That's what I tried to tell myself.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So after a while, I started looking into religious communities, again, the convent.
Yeah.
And I went to a number of different congregations, and I spent lots of time with the Sisters of the Cenacle.
Okay.
To me, they did very priestly work. Mm-hmm. Their charism is spiritual direction and retreat work.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, spiritual direction, you hear a lot of confessions.
Yeah.
And retreat work, the rituals in retreats are much like Mass. So
okay.
I figured that would be a good way to live out my call.
And?
After spending a number of years with them and getting to know a number of the women and loving it, it still wasn't it.
Okay.
It still wasn't it.
Yeah. Let me, I'm just wondering, do you ever get, I'm jumping ahead, mm-hmm. but do you ever get people questioning your motives that, you know, clearly you're not being the obedient Catholic that we're all supposed to be, that you have some kind of power thing, that you need to be at the priest, you know?
Well, that could be asked of men also.
Very true.
The power part of it especially, and their vocations are tested. Ours, we don't have the opportunity to test our vocations in that way.
Okay.
And more than being a good Catholic is the primacy of conscience.
Uh-huh.
And my conscience was saying that this is right, and that it is God who is calling me.
Mm-hmm.
So
where do you take this urge, this call? Where did you go? What did you do?
A couple of things. And it was being confirmed by a number of people. Some people thought, as I said, that I was on staff. One person called me a cleric. He said of all the clerics in this particular church, the one he was closest to was me. Another woman asked me, she was of the Episcopal tradition, and she asked me when I was going to become a mother. And I said, I am. I have two children. And she said, that's not what I mean. I mean a priest. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that the title that you use?
No, I don't,
okay.
But they do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How lovely.
Yeah.
Do you use a title yourself when you apply it? I mean...
Only in a formal occasion. I'll use reverend.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Say when I'm presiding at a wedding.
I forgot there's a gender-neutral version. That's
yeah.
right. Reverend
yeah.
works perfectly.
Yeah. yeah. Or if I don't usually wear a Roman collar except... Again, when the situation calls for it, if I am, say, at a demonstration calling for justice,
mm-hmm.
I will wear a Roman collar.
It adds a little gravitas to the message.
Yeah, it does. It says more than I could in words.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the way I do that.
How did you cross paths with whoever it was that ordained you?
Roman Catholic women priests. Now, this is how it started. I was in the parish doing so much. One of the women in the parish handed me a flyer, a newspaper, for Call to Action. Are you familiar with Call to Action?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a reform group for Catholics,
yep.
Church reform group. And she said, I didn't know of it at the time. She said, if there's anything in here that appeals to you and you want to go, I'll pay for everything.
Mm.
I'll pay for the plane, I'll pay for the hotel, and I'll pay for the conference fee. Well, there was plenty in there that appealed to me.
Yes.
And that particular year, there was a pre-conference for Women's Ordination Conference,
yeah.
which is a group that started probably about 78, I think.
Okay.
And they have been working towards the ordination of women since then. So I went to the pre-conference at Women's Ordination Conference,
okay.
and they broke down into small groups.
Had you known of such a group at that point? Or
no.
No. Was it exciting?
Oh, it was very exciting.
Because now
yeah.
this is speaking to your desire from eons ago.
Yes, and there are many women like me.
Yeah,
right. Whereas I felt very isolated
yeah.
before. Yeah. So, and one of the things that they did at the pre-conference was they asked the women who felt called to ordination to stand, and I did,
okay.
in public.
Wow.
They were about 20 of us, and then they asked us to come to the front, and that was a very, very powerful experience, too.
Yeah, like an altar call. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this small...
Was it like an out-of-body experience for you to make that walk to the front of the church?
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was certainly not, it didn't feel real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what happened up there at the front of the church?
Well, they applauded. They validated our call, mm-hmm. the rest of the audience, mm-hmm. the community. But the significant part of that conference was the small group that I went to. It was a group of women who had formed from the Women's Ordination Conference from all over the country, and they felt called, they all felt called to ordination the way the church is at that point. And it was a covenanted community. They committed loyalty, responsibility, support to each other, and they met twice a year. And I spoke to the woman giving the workshop, and I wrote to her, and I was accepted into that group.
Okay.
And so I was a member. And
that must have felt like stepping onto a path.
It was amazing. It was amazing because here were a group of women that were not just grieving, not just angry, but working, strategizing, doing real work in order to bring this about.
Yeah.
They developed relationships with the friendly bishops.
Okay.
And
on earth did they find these bishops?
Well, you would really know who would be open to it and who would not be open to it, and from what they say and how they deal with things and personal mm-hmm. contact and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So, and then they connected with them and developed relationships with them.
Mm-hmm.
They even had the Episcopal bishops who ordained the women in the Episcopal Church come and talk to the Catholic bishops.
Oh.
It's another thing they did, yeah.
Very, so, very crafty, Mr. Bond.
Yes. Yeah, so they were working towards any kind of ordination, deathbed ordination, nobody will know ordination, which we now call, in Roman Catholic women priests, we call catacomb ordination.
Catacomb.
Yeah, but it didn't happen in this country, and this group had been meeting at that point probably for 25 years, maybe. Yeah.
Did bishops on their deathbed really ordain women priests?
Well, we were hoping that would happen.
Oh, okay.
And as far as I know, it did not.
Okay.
But if it had to be held secret, then I wouldn't know.
Yeah.
So
interesting. So these ordinations that are not happening in this country, what country are they happening in?
Well, now, through this group that I belong to,
yeah.
We found out about this program in Europe.
Okay.
That in 2002, some Austrian and German women contacted the bishops throughout the world asking for ordination, and three of them responded yes.
Wow.
So they got a boat on the Danube River.
Yeah.
And
I read that. That's amazing.
Yes,
they have to be on the water.
Yeah, for security reasons, as well as the symbolism of the church turning around, because at the point of the ordination, the boat turned and to go back.
Oh.
So the symbolism as well as security reasons, yeah. So seven women were ordained in 2002 to the priesthood.
Was it also a matter of not being in a particular diocese?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It was international water, so no bishop had jurisdiction.
It's just brilliant. Okay. So then you hear about this happening, and what are you doing?
Well, I had made a friend who was ordained in the interfaith tradition. And
what does that mean?
She studied in many different faiths, and so she was able to minister to many different people.
But she was ordained a Roman Catholic priest.
No, no, she was ordained an interfaith minister.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
There are programs that
I
you
see.
Can do that. Yeah. So she studied many different backgrounds and traditions.
Okay.
And she, at one point, she was Roman Catholic, but at one point organized something to be ordained in the Catholic tradition. It wasn't official. It wasn't anything that was backed up by anything. I mean, it's really the people that ordained her, which...
Not a bishop. It was the congregation.
Well, yeah, which has its historic point.
Mm-hmm. But it's not the so-called apostolic succession approach. Okay.
Correct. And the people, the clerics, the religious, came to me and said, "You're next," and it didn't feel right to me. That's not what it was.
Yeah.
It didn't feel right.
To be an interfaith priest.
To be ordained in this manner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did she call herself a priest?
Yes.
Okay.
She did. So it didn't feel right, so I never participated in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I found out that the following year, out of the seven women that were ordained as priests on the Danube, two of them were made bishops by male bishops in good standing with Rome in full apostolic succession. And they were made bishops. So they were in line with the apostolic succession.
Wow.
The following year, there was a Dominican nun in South Africa, Patricia Friesen, who was a Dominican nun for over 30 years, 35 years. In any case, she had this call. She was a professor at the university. She taught at the seminary. She went to jail fighting apartheid, a woman of great integrity.
Yeah, yeah.
And she had gone to Germany to meet with these women who were priests at that point when she went. And very hopeful, she went back to South Africa. The following year, when they were made bishops, two of them, she went back to Germany because they wrote her and said, "Now we can make you a priest." And so she went back to Germany, and they ordained her to the priesthood. Well, she was subsequently forced to leave her community, and she moved to Germany.
Her religious community?
Her religious community.
Okay.
Yeah. So she lost her religious community, she lost her job, she lost her pension, she lost her country, and she lost her language, her family. So it was very, very difficult.
Wow.
Yeah. So she was living in Germany with one of the women bishops, and one of the male bishops, again in full apostolic succession and good standing with Rome, said to her, "You speak English. We want you to bring the program to the United States, because the women in the United States are well-educated and not easily intimidated by Rome." Yeah. So she said, "I've been through a lot. This is. Let me pray about it. Let me discern." They said, "There's no time." They said, "This is not for you. This is for the women in the United States. This is so that the movement can grow." And so she did. She became a bishop, and the first ordination that she presided at was on the St. Lawrence River in 2005. And it was on the river again, international water. I was there. There were small boats on either side of the larger boat, because if anyone disrupted the liturgy, they would be taken off the boat and put on the small boat so that the larger one wouldn't have to be interrupted.
And they wouldn't be tossed into the drink.
No. There were undercover people on the boat.
Wow.
Yeah, in case that happened. Yeah.
Was there ever any need for all the security? Did anyone ever?
Not in my experience, but we didn't know what to expect.
Right,
there were
right.
a lot of threats. I mean, if you go online and read some of the articles, you'll get an earful on some of the people that don't believe that we are priests and don't believe that we're in full apostolic succession.
Yeah.
A lot of times they don't know the history.
Right. You know, since we were talking about apostolic succession, mm-hmm. it occurs to me that some listeners might not know what we're referring to. Can you mm-hmm. give a pithy definition of that?
Well, some people say it goes back to the time of the apostles, laying on of hands from then. But there were a lot of disruptions from the beginning and through the centuries of that. So in essence, it's that our tradition of Catholicism goes back to the apostles, where it might not be a full laying on of hands for each generation. We have full apostolic succession the way the institutional church defines it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, I'm not sure if they were this kind of ordination in the beginning of the church. There were times when um, there were three popes at one time in history. You know, so there were a lot of that kind of disruption in the history of the church.
Right.
So that's the way I usually say it. As the institutional church defines it, that's what we have in full apostolic succession, because the bishops that ordained the female bishops have a lineage, and it's documented. I don't know how far back they go, but they pass on a document, an actual document that goes far back.
Right.
Of one laying hands on the other. Yeah.
So you're on this boat?
In 2005, and I cried the whole time.
Oh.
Yeah. That was in 2005.
Well, you cried because it was so overwhelmingly powerful, because it was emotion. What was it that what was your emotion?
It was really hard to define, because it was overwhelmingly powerful, because it was a relief that finally there is a way for women to become priests.
Yeah.
And the possibility that maybe I could become a priest.
Ah, right. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm guessing
was
going on.
Yeah.
This was about you next.
Yeah.
So, in effect, you get back on shore, and what do you do?
Well, this was in August. By October, I applied. I still wasn't sure, but I read a talk given by Patricia Friesen in Philadelphia, and that talk said to me, this is it, this is it. Mm. And so I wrote to her, I emailed her, and I said, yes, 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 I'm ready.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And so I began the process in 2005. In 2006, there was another ordination, the first ordination on land in the United States. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't on land. It was still in a boat in the United States. It was the first ordination in the United States.
In the United States waters, in effect?
Yes. Yeah. And it was in Pittsburgh on the conjunction of the three rivers.
Oh, that seems also rather symbolic.
Yes, actually, yeah.
Trinitarian, maybe?
Yes. Yep.
So when you say I started the process, I mean, you can't attend a seminary. What do you do?
I didn't know that women could attend a seminary, but I had been in seminary since 94.
So you went, did you attend a seminary?
Yes, I did.
To become a priest? Not
to become a priest. 94, I was at that parish, and because I was so active and beginning to preach, the pastor said to me, I think I need to send you to the seminary. Actually, I had been writing in my prayer journal that I wished I had been able to go to the seminary. I didn't even know where it was, how I would get there, because I didn't have a car. And 6 months later, the pastor is offering to send me to the seminary and pay for it, because I had no money. I had kids.
Right.
So I did attend a Catholic seminary from 94 to 99, studied theology. The Masters of Divinity, which is the priestly degree, is not offered to women in that particular seminary, and generally not in Catholic seminaries. They were in financial trouble, and their advisors said to offer the MDiv to women, Masters of Divinity to women, and they would make money, and they said no.
Oh.
So we were not allowed to take any classes with anybody who was becoming a priest.
Okay.
Now, I have a friend who went to a Catholic seminary and was allowed to get an MDiv, but she was not allowed to take any classes about the sacraments.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah. So,
it's
like segregation.
Yeah, really. Ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what?
So I was in the seminary. Yeah. So this is 2006 by now in Pittsburgh. And I was on the boat again, and again crying. The tears just streamed down my face for the whole time. And everybody there was allowed, after the bishops laid their hands on the heads of the ordinands, everybody was invited to do the same. And I was on the line just crying.
Yeah.
And one of the German women who was ordained in 2002 on the Danube crossed the floor to where I was and just looked me in the eyes and patted my hands.
Mm.
It was so moving. It was so moving. It's hard to describe. So that was 2006. in 2007, the first ordination on land happened in New York City.
Of course.
In Manhattan.
If you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. That's what I hear.
Yeah. But it was also symbolic because it was on the rock. Manhattan.
Oh.
Manhattan is a rock.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. And
is Manhattan more of a rock than any other landmass?
It's an island. Well, okay. It's an island, and it's bedrock.
Okay.
That's what it is.
Okay.
It's bedrock. So there are some peripheral parts of it that are salt marsh, or had been salt marsh and were filled in, but most of it is a rock.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was 2007, the first ordination in Manhattan, and I was ordained to the diaconate by Patricia Friesen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
that was a step toward the priesthood, I'm guessing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a transitional diaconate, a transitional ordination.
And of course, this is all very hush hush. I mean, the bishop who performed this, we don't know who he is, and we don't get to know. I imagine.
That's right. That's right. But Patricia Friesen is in full apostolic succession, so I am validly ordained, if illegally. I'm illegally ordained, but validly.
Well, you know, since you bring that up, I have a little mental note to ask you something. I didn't want to interrupt the chronology, but maybe this is the moment. Does it seem inconsistent that you respect the apostolic succession so much, but not the prohibition against women priests? You know, I mean, is this kind of cherry-picking the rules that you'll abide by?
Well, as Patricia Friesen said, it's an unjust law. And what you do with an unjust law is you break it. And that's why she went to jail fighting apartheid.
Right.
Because that was also an unjust law.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is how we make progress,
that's
is
right.
Challenging unjust. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, keep going. You have my attention.
So I was ordained to the diaconate by Patricia Friesen. And part of the liturgy is you lie prostrate on the floor.
Right.
The traditional ordination of men, the men promise or turn their lives over to promise obedience to the bishops. We do not. We turn our lives over to God. We promise obedience to God, not to the bishops.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, the women bishops move out of the way, so it's clear. So I'm lying prostrate on the floor, turning my life over to God. And that hole in my soul since I was 5 was filled up.
Mm.
There was peace.
Mm.
The anger was gone.
Yeah.
It was all a very, very powerful moment.
Wow.
Yeah. So there was a year between my diaconate ordination and my ordination to the priesthood.
Okay.
And during that time, I started a prayer group, a scripture study group, practiced preaching. And it was like a retreat year, discerning and praying and spending time with God and listening to God in the call. And then in July of 2008 in Boston, I was ordained to the priesthood in Boston. And that was right after the Vatican said that those who attempt ordination, those women who attempt to be ordained, and those who attempt to confer ordination on women have automatically excommunicated themselves.
Yeah.
So we excommunicated ourselves during that time.
In their view, I mean, I'm sure
in
you
their
don't.
View, no. We feel that excommunication only has power if you give it power.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't give it power. Mm-hmm. Although people have lost many things being excommunicated, but we don't give it power because, as I said, it's an unjust law.
So now you're a priest at that moment, and what do you do with it? You go out and find yourself a parish?
What was powerful during that time, especially since we had this thing about excommunication, we had a lot of press,
mm-hmm.
There are articles in Vietnamese about that ordination.
Wow.
Yes.
It, just for the record, the ordination was in Boston, and was it on land or water?
It was on land.
Okay.
Yeah. Many of the...
Was it in a cathedral? Was it in a church?
It was in a Presbyterian church.
Oh.
Yeah. UCC and Presbyterian have been very good to us.
Okay.
Yeah. So many of the journalists who I was interviewed by, we were interviewed by, have wished us congratulations and have said they were former Catholics, many of them.
Sure.
And
especially in Boston, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they did come from all over, too.
Okay, right,
yeah.
Right.
And then we had 500 people in the church, and it was July, and it was 95 degrees in the church, and it was not air-conditioned.
Oh.
And the service was 3 hours long, and no one left.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's a historical event.
Yes, it was. And it was a very powerful and very moving event. Yeah. And then after the service, a lot of men, came up to us and to me asking for the priest's first blessing.
Oh.
So looking at the eyes of the journalists, and seeing the people in the pews and hearing the people asking for our blessing, I knew that the sense of the faith of the people, the sensus fidelium,
yeah,
was that we're not excommunicated,
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm,
this is real.
Right. So then, what?
Then, my son-in-law, a month after that, he's a firefighter, and he had an accident fighting a fire,
oh,
and yeah, he was severely injured, and so I didn't start anything for a while. But by November, people were looking for me,
mm-hmm,
and asking when I was going to start something,
okay,
and so I started in my home, presiding at Mass,
yeah,
in my home, and
wow, what was your first Mass like for you?
Oh, it was amazing. After
you must have been just, I don't know, I can't decide if you were jumping out of your skin or just so completely peaceful.
Both.
Yeah, yeah.
Both. A young woman afterwards said to me, "This is so extraordinary and yet so ordinary."
Yeah.
Yeah. So we held Mass in my home for a while. Then we were in two churches in Brooklyn for a while. We couldn't afford the rent, and New York is quite expensive.
Right.
And so we started going from home to home. Parishioners would volunteer their homes, and we traveled from home to home.
Mm.
It was difficult because New York is large, and depending on where it was located, other people felt they couldn't come.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we weren't growing that way. So,
mm-hmm,
probably about a year and a half ago, I was offered a community room in somebody's co-op.
Okay.
And we have been celebrating Mass in that location for a year and a half to 2 years now, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is there anything that a visitor to Mass in this community room would find different, except for, of course, that the priest is a woman?
Mm-hmm.
Do you do anything differently than a regular priest would do,
yeah,
at Mass?
Yeah. We sit in a circle.
Okay.
I have written the liturgy, the Mass, to use inclusive language.
Mm-hmm.
We also use inclusive language for God, mm-hmm, or neutral language for God. The hymns, we tried to make inclusive also.
And what's your congregation like? How many people?
Well, there are... Let me just say one more thing.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
We don't do victim theology either.
What do you mean?
The traditional Mass says, "Lord, I am not worthy to receive you."
Yeah.
We say, "Jesus, you make me worthy to receive you."
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah.
Any other changes to the prayers? What the heck? You may as well change them. The Vatican's changing them.
true. That's true. Yeah, there's some changes to the creed and things like that. Not anything. And like I said, to be more inclusive, to be more responsive to the needs of the people and that kind of thing.
Well,
and I bring a lot of justice issues to my homilies.
Yeah.
I have, I put out a newsletter once a month, and I focus on spirituality in the newsletter.
I've read it online. It's beautiful.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, I read one of your homilies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so you went to our website.
I did.
Okay. There was one that my favorite is the one about the talents.
Yes.
I don't know if that's the one.
Right. No, not that one.
Okay.
Tell me about that.
The gospel story is that there is a rich man, a very wealthy man, who is leaving his property in the hands of three of his servants, and he leaves them some money, and he expects to get more money from that when he comes back. And when he comes back, the first one has made a lot more money on that money, and he said, good servant. And the second one made not as much, but some, and said, good servant. And the third buried it. And because he was afraid of the master, and he was afraid to lose it. And the traditional interpretation there is that the third one is lazy. But the way I see it, I still am involved with Occupy Wall Street. So with that as a background, the way I see it, the master was to be feared. And it actually says in Scripture that he sowed, he reaped where he did not sow. So he exploited, and that's how he got his money. And the third one was afraid of him, and that's why he buried it. But I see it as passive resistance. He did not cooperate with what, I think he was the courageous one out of the three. Not that he was lazy, he was the courageous one. And he buried it as an act of passive resistance, nonviolent passive resistance.
This is a revisionist view. This is great.
Yeah. It's nothing that the scriptures don't say.
Well, I thought I picked up a tone of condemnation of the third guy.
Yeah. Yeah, but...
But that's only because the master is such an evil
SOB. Yes. Yes. And the traditional view of this also is that the master is God, and it can't be. If there's exploitation involved, if there's condemnation involved, if there is fear involved, it's not God.
Oh. Well, very good.
Yeah. So that's another thing that you probably won't hear in other churches.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
You know, it's coming back to me now. The one that I read had to do, and maybe I'm not characterizing it correctly as a homily, but it was just a lovely little exhortation to go out into nature, you know, and let that experience affect you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. One of the women's religious communities that I spent some time with, I introduced myself as an ecofeminist with mystical leanings tending towards the radical.
Beautiful.
And I asked if I would fit in.
Yeah. Do you know there's going to be an ecofeminism conference up here at Wesleyan?
Oh, wow.
You might want to come.
Oh, I'd love to.
I'll send you the information.
Great. Yeah.
And speaking of sharing information, just because I'm afraid I'll forget to leave time for this, how can people, I mean, where are you and how can people connect with you if they're so inclined? I mean, New York is not that big a haul for us from Connecticut.
Yeah. In fact, I do have some people on my list who have attended Mass a couple of times from Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My email address, I could give you that.
Yeah, do.
ST, as in Saint.
Yes.
ST, Praxitus, P as in Peter, R-A-X-E-D as in David, I-S, Praxitus. So it's Saint Praxitus, R-C-C, for Roman Catholic Church, @gmail.com.
Okay. And Saint Praxitus, for the record, is who?
Saint Praxitus was a woman who in the very early church, gathered up the blood and the bones of the martyrs. And
martyrs from, say, the Colosseum?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. She's also depicted in a mosaic, and it's on the website. The mosaic, a copy of the mosaic, is on the website for Roman Catholic Women Priests, RomanCatholicWomenPriests.org.
Mm-hmm.
It's on there.
Mm-hmm.
She is the second from the left.
Okay.
And according to Dorothy Irvin, who is a theologian,
yes,
and an archaeologist, she feels that Praxitus was Greek, and that she was brought to Rome to instruct the daughters of the wealthy in Greek. And in this depiction in the mosaic, there is the woman on the left. There is written in the mosaic, Theodora Episcopa,
oh,
which means Theodora was a bishop. And Praxitus is shoulder to shoulder with her and wearing the same pectoral cross.
Oh.
So Dorothy Irvin feels that Praxitus was also a bishop. Even though she was enslaved, she was also a bishop.
Do you have aspirations to be a bishop yourself?
Our bishops are different from the bishops of the institution.
That's good.
Yes. First, they're elected. And second, they're there to be pastoral. They're not there to be administrative. The administrative portion of it is given to others.
So is this your way of saying, yes, I would be a pretty good bishop?
I'm very pastoral, but I don't aspire to that. It's a calling from the people.
Uh-huh. I can't believe I'm looking at the clock spinning here, and we're almost out of time, and I'm afraid that if we go on much longer, I'm going to end up having to make hard decisions about what to cut, because this is only a one-hour show. What is your website?
The website is St. Praxitus Catholic Community.org.
Okay. Is there anything else you feel you'd like to say before I regretfully let you get back to your real life?
Yes. We have an open table. Anybody who comes with respect, anybody who is seeking can join us in the Eucharist. We open it to all.
That's
you don't
lovely.
Have to be Catholic.
Ah, beautiful. Okay. And do you have non-Catholics among your flock?
Yes.
I don't want to end on this note. It's, too disturbing, but, I mean, have you experienced any ugliness from people who are against you?
No.
Oh, interesting. That's great. That's very good. Well, I'm just delighted to have talked to you, and I think you should expect to see me at your table sometime, maybe even soon.
That would be great.
Yeah.
I look forward to meeting you.
Yeah, me too. We have a lot in common. I mean, I'm not going to include this in the show. I'll probably exit out, but... a lot of our history, even though I'm maybe 10 years younger than you, we've been walking the same path in a way.
Oh, wow.
You know, I was a Buddhist for 10 years.
Wow.
And I'm Italian. I'm a vegan. It's like, oh, my gosh, all my little bells and whistles are fire.
Wow.
Yeah. But you know what? It's just time, What do you feel? I just can't help asking you what you feel is the future for this movement.
I used to say that we're the fringes, but the center is getting smaller and smaller, and the fringes are getting larger and larger. And pretty soon the fringes will be welcoming the center back into the church.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears. Very good. Reverend, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Really, really good to talk to you. And maybe I can persuade you to come back another time.
Sure.
You know, we have a book panel now and then, and we could patch you in from afar. Now that I know how to use this machine, and you could maybe recommend some good spiritual reading to people as part of our book panel.
Wonderful.
You know,
could I say one more thing?
Sure, please.
I've been a spiritual director for about 17 years, and I specialize in our focus on adult survivors of child abuse. So that's a whole other program.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, I just came from the 10th anniversary conference of Voice of the Faithful in Boston.
Right.
And so that's on my radar. In fact, that's going to be the next show on the 16th. You might want to check out the website about that, since it's, I mean, I'm not going to tell you anything you don't already know because you ply this ground, but it's not over, that part of the sad church history.
And it's much more extensive than people even recognize,
and
historically.
Yeah, terrible. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that the phenomenon of women priests is kind of a cure for that in a way? Maybe cure is too strong a word.
I think that if women were in the rectories, they wouldn't have gotten away with it for so long. I think... it's the nature of the position to attract people who are hiding from their sexuality because of the celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what the woman brings, and it also depends on what the man brings.
Yeah. Yep. So no generalizations are really possible there.
Yeah, but I do think that if women were in the rectory, they wouldn't have been able to hide it.
Thank you again. Looking forward to meeting you.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to meeting you, too.
This will be great. I'm going to bring a friend. The two of us are going to come down on the train, and we'll see you on the 14th.
Great.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. Yeah.